Is it working?
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. So, as I said, what I'm going to talk about mostly is about SLT-based model checking for real-time and fault tolerance system. I'm not going to talk much about SMT by itself, but you'll see applications of what other people have described in these examples. So before I go into that, I will try to motivate the story by telling you what fault tolerance systems and why they are interesting. Okay, so here is an example. So, modern aircraft like this guy, this is an Airbus F320, are all controlled by what's called fly-by-wire systems or flight control systems that are all digital. And this, what these systems do is they read, so there's no mechanical contact between what the pilot does and what the plane does. There's always a computer in between. What these systems do is they read whatever the pilot commands are. They read various sensors that are everywhere around the plane, like measuring airspeed, measuring pressure, angle of attacks, and other things. And they use this, plus this, to compute the control commands that have to be sent to the control surface of the plane. So these flaps and ailerons and stuff here. So the main point is that these systems have to be extremely reliable. And by FAA regulation in the US and similar regulations outside of the US, you must show that the flight control system has a probability of failure which is less than 10 to the minus 9 failures per hour. And this cannot be achieved without redundancy. Ordinary hardware is not good enough to achieve that. Okay, so there are some evidence or some ad hoc experiments have shown that ordinary hardware doesn't reach this level. It's more like 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7 failure per hour. So here is a very crude picture of what's highly redundant digital system of the kind they use in avionics. It's essentially a set of redundant sensors, so everything is redundant. They don't trust any sensor, they always collect data from several sensors. There are redundant communication channels, redundant controllers, and then the same thing redundant actuators. And redundant means also like the mechanics is redundant, so you have several actuators operating on the same control surface. So what's the problem now? Our goal, when we have to analyze these kind of systems, is to show that the actual fault tolerance requirements are satisfied. So what we want is to show that the system satisfies whatever control requirements it has, possibly with some degraded modes of operation, even if some of the components in the system are faulty. And one of the main issues to guarantee this kind of property is to make sure that all the computers agree on the control command they compute, even if some of the sensors and some of the computers themselves are faulty. And there are different types of faults people consider. The simplest kind of fault is something called fail stop or a crash, where a component just crashes and just like it's absent from the system, it doesn't send any data to anything. There are more malicious kind of failures that you also have to consider. Another case of a failure is something called inconsistent commission, where a component sends the correct data, is not sending malicious data, it's just sending some of the data to some of the components and nothing to the others. This is already a kind of asymmetric failure, so the component fails in a way that looks different depending on the other components. It's not a symmetric fault that everybody observes in the same way. There are other kinds of faults. Symmetric faults are usually easier to tolerate than these kind of asymmetric faults, but you can also have symmetric faults where the data is incorrect. So one component is sending incorrect data, but it sends the same incorrect data to everybody. And the worst case is what's called Byzantine faults, where the component is completely arbitrary. So it can send nothing to some other component, it can send incorrect data to other component, it can send correct data to another part. One of the issues is in a Unix system is you have to make sure that you have to tolerate, at least to some extent, this kind of very difficult to control as Byzantine vehicle. So there are two general classes of approaches to achieving that, that are used in practice. One idea, one philosophy, actually, there's a hot debate between the two camps on which approach is better. One of the classical approaches is to make sure that everything is synchronous, everything is synchronized. If you manage to synchronize all the computers, then you can treat them as identical replicates. Because they are synchronized, they can execute some voting algorithms. They always read the same data from the same sensor. They can, accept the sensor is faulty, but anyway, they can vote on the input they receive and guarantee that they are going to process the same input. They can maintain the exact same state, and they can produce bit for bit equal output. But this is only possible if you have synchronous systems. Another approach, so one of the questions about this kind of problem is how do you make sure that the system is synchronous? That's one of the difficulties in this approach. In the asynchronous camp, there's a different philosophy which says it's too hard to maintain the system synchronous, and if you lose synchrony in this context, you lose everything. So So from some point of view, this idea of the synchronous system makes it more brittle. So some people are violently against the synchronous system and they want only asynchronous. And in a synchronous system, you basically let the controller work without trying to synchronize. They exchange data, but there is no guarantee that they are all working at the same rate. And what that means is that there is no guarantee that they can ever produce the exact same control. Because they get data from the sensors at different points in time. There's no guarantee that the values are going to be exactly the same. And as a consequence of that, they cannot guarantee that both will be the same. So then what they do to compensate for that is that in the arms, at the back end of the system, around the actuators here, so sometimes the actuators are themselves contain themselves computers that basically figure out how to combine input from different controllers. In these actuators, they use different kind of voting schemes or decide which values are correct or incorrect depending on thresholds. And there are different schemes that people use to decide what's the actual command you send based on possibly different control input that the actuator is going to receive. So I'm not going to talk much about asynchronous systems because most of my work has been on this other part. So, and especially on this particular architecture, which is called the time trigger Ethernet. So I'm not sure the picture is very clear, but time trigger Ethernet is an extension of normal Ethernet for real-time fault tolerant systems. And one of the main properties it guarantees is that it provides very reliable communication channels with guarantees of real-time quality of the communication. So it guarantees that every communication, every message sent on a particular channel will be received with a very low jitter and very low latency, and the latency is predictable, and it also guarantees that there will be no collision between any other transmission. And the way this is achieved is by making sure that all the nodes in the network, so both the end system and the switches are synchronized, and they all operate using a global communication schedule. So at every point in time, they know who is supposed to send on each channel, and they also know who is supposed to receive the same data. So these are the main protocols that are implemented inside the switches and the end systems of CT. And all of them must be fault tolerant. So one very important protocol is something they call the startup protocol. So when you power on around the system. You start with a totally unsynchronized system. Nobody knows about anything. And the purpose of the startup protocol is to make sure that after a small amount of time, you reach a state where everybody is synchronized. And this has to be achieved even if some of the nodes are faulty, even in the startup, even initially. As I said, you also need cross-synchronization to make sure that all the clocks remain synchronized with each other. So this has to be executed periodically because in physical systems, the clocks are not perfect enough, are not perfect, so they will eventually drift from each other. So if you want to maintain the whole system synchronous, you have to periodically resynchronize to make sure the clocks are the same. And there's something else they use in case of disaster. So what can happen if whatever kind of fault tolerance mechanism you have, there's always cases where your system will be overwhelmed by things like thunder or something like that affects a large portion of your system. That's what they call network-wide transient upset. It's transient in the sense that it's not going to last forever, but it's going to disable a significant amount of your system. And they use a specific protocol to recover from this situation. It's a little bit similar to the startup, but it's more complicated because it can happen that during this restart, some of the systems, some of the components were already following a specific schedule, and the other components were affected by the transient, but they still have to resynchronize with the rest of the system. And what you want to avoid is to end up in a network where two subsets of the nodes from different peaks, they are synchronized with each other, two subsets, within each subset of the nodes are synchronized, but they all, but the two subsets work within different peaks. So they use special protocols for achieving that. And these are the fault assumptions for TT Ethernet. So actually there are two classes of TT Ethernet depending on how you want to implement it and how much cost you want to support. The simplest case is something they call the single fault configuration. And as the name indicates, this assumes that all these protocols will tolerate at most one faulty configuration. And depending on the component that's faulty, either if it's an AND system, then there's no particular assumption. It can be a Byzantine faulty component. But the switches cannot be Byzantine faulty. Okay? So the assumption is either that you have a faulty AND system that's Byzantine or a faulty switch that has the inconsistent omission failure behavior. So it just drops messages in an asymmetric way. And then there's a more robust configuration where you have more redundancy. And in that case, the system can tolerate two faulty components. But again, one of the assumptions in this case is that no component is Byzantine. So either you have two faulty switches, or two faulty AND system, or one faulty AND system and one faulty switch. But all of them have to have this inconsistent omission behavior. So that may sound like it's a little bit cheating, but the way they achieve this stuff, the assumption that the components are not Byzantine is by actually making sure every component is what they call a self-checking pair. So every component is actually two components that are basically cross-checking each other. And if you do that, and if you can show with reasonable probability that the two pairs are independent, fairly independently, then you can guarantee that the whole system is, these components are not Byzantine. Okay, so these are the verification problems. So these protocols, as you can imagine, are not trivial. And showing that they are correct is a good part of all airplane certification, especially for TTE, the company that sells this stuff. It's a very good argument for them to show that, yes? So TTE itself is a joint between Honeywell in the US and a company called TTE Tech in Vienna. So TTE, everything that starts with TTE comes from the time trigger philosophy, which is from Hermann Kopex. And Hermann Kopex is a professor in Vienna and also the founder of this TTE Tech.
And what does Airbus use?
So Airbus. So this is a recent thing that nobody, a recent protocol that nobody really uses yet. They are in the asynchronous camp, as far as I understand. I mean, I suspect that actually most airlines, most well, I guess in various Boeing systems, there's a mix. Some part of the system use the synchronous approach, but other parts use the asynchronous approach. But I believe that Airbus is fully asynchronous. Okay, so yeah, as I said, these protocols are not obvious, and making sure that they work properly is very important for the people who build them, and it's also very important for certification. One of the main costs in all these avionics systems is not just developing the system, but testing it and verifying it and making sure that you can convince the FAA or whoever is in charge that the system is safe. So, in our case, what we want to do is use model checking to prove that the systems work properly under the fault assumptions. And also, what's very important is for the designers of the system to provide comparisons. If you say, if your tool is just there to show that the protocol is correct, it's not very interesting. Because most of the time, during the design phases, the protocol is not correct. And what matters is to provide comparisons. So here are the issues that are specific to this domain. Is you have to deal with both with real-time aspects, like timers, communication delays, and so on. You have to model the fault assumptions. You have to model the clocks and the clock drift, depending on which part of the system you want. And of course, my goal is to make this proof as automatic as possible.
Question?
Yeah?
I guess the protocols are parameterized for different possible configurations of the network. So, I would expect that also the multiplicity of configuration is an issue, right? I mean, depending on how many peers you attach to the...
So, yeah, that's a good point. In all the examples I'm going to talk about, it's always verifying a finite configuration of the protocol, because that's pretty much what model checking can do. If you want to prove the protocol correct in full generality, you have to use other techniques. And people use interactive term proving and stuff like that for this general case. But this CT, I don't think, has ever been fully verified for all configurations. Okay, so let me recall something that Fabio was talking about yesterday and also Ken. So the basic for all these approaches, we are going to model our protocol and our system as a state transition system. And then we are going to encode this as symbolically so that the system can be processed using SMT. So we assume that we can model all our system using a set. Finite set of variables, they can be real, they can be discrete. We have an initialization formula that defines initial states, and then we have a transition relation that tells us how we move from one state to the next. Okay, so then the execution traces of this state transition system will be any sequence of states such that x0 is one of the allowed initial states, and then for every step in the sequence, the pair is really their XT and predecessor and successor is satisfy the transition relation. Okay? So, one approach, which is very useful, especially for generating counterexamples, is to do bounded knowledge checking. And the goal of bounded knowledge checking is to find counterexamples, essentially. I mean, maybe there's some generalization where you can also use bounded knowledge checking for proving correctness, but this usually requires extra information about the system. And in all the cases I'm going to consider, essentially the property we care about is an invariant. So we want to show that some P, which is a state property, is satisfied by all reachable states. So if this is our assumption, then bounded knowledge checking is a technique for finding a reachable state that doesn't satisfy P. And the technique is we look for traces of a fixed map. Essentially, we fix the bound K and we search for a state that can be reached in at most K step, or in this formulation here, exactly K steps. And this is done by just controlling the transition relation and then requiring that the last state of the sequence here does not satisfy you. So you send this stuff to the DSLT server, if there is a comparison for that trace that you can show the user, and that shows that he is not satisfied. Yeah? But this particular version is more for debugging. You have a system that you want to test whether it works or not.
And it uses that as hot finding, you want to verify that the system satisfies the...
No, yeah, it's bug finding, yes. But there are extensions that I'm going to show in a few minutes that allow you to do verification using exactly the same thing. Okay? So then, beyond the debugging, as you were just asking, we can use induction. Induction is the primary technique we're going to use to show that some property is invariant. And the standard induction scheme is this. To show that P is invariant, we check whether all the initial states satisfy P. And then we show that if we start from a state that satisfies P, all successive states will also satisfy P. And if this is satisfied, then P is invariant and is actually something called an inductive invariant. Okay? So if you get lucky, you try simple induction and it works. But what happens if induction fails? So there are some two cases. Either the first part of the condition is not satisfied, then you know immediately that P is not an invariant. There are some initial states that don't satisfy P, so P, your system is incorrect. P is not invariant. And the second case is when the induction part of the proof fails, which is the more common case. So what happens in this case? It tells us that there is a state that satisfies P, and one of its successors does not satisfy P. Okay? You have an X0 that satisfies P, and then one of its successors does not satisfy. So if X0 is reachable, we also know that P is not invariant, because if X0 is reachable, then X1 is also reachable. Okay? But that doesn't help much unless we can check whether X0 is reachable. And usually that's not satisfied. And also, in general, when this step fails, we don't know exactly whether P is invariant or not. So what we can do is try different techniques that try to improve the situation. And I'm going to describe three of them here. What we can do is try to strengthen the invariant. We can try to use an auxiliary invariant, some other invariant we found from summarized as a lemma. Or we can use stronger induction rules. Let's go for strengthening the invariant. It's something that Ken described yesterday. It's essentially, we try to find a stronger invariant than P, but another property, Q, that's an inductive invariant, and that's stronger than P, which basically means that you have to show this. So you have to find a Q that satisfies that. Okay? There's a typo here. It should be Q of X0 implies P of X0. Okay? Another technique is use auxiliary lemmas as invariant. So assume we have found by some other means or by some static analysis technique or whatever, we have found some auxiliary invariant out. Then we can try to use this to help us prove whether P is invariant. And the rule we use for that is this. We try to prove that all the initial states satisfy P. And then if we start from a state that satisfies P and satisfies all the L, then all its successors will also satisfy. Okay? So if this property is true, then we can deduce, it's pretty obvious that P is also invariant, because we know that all the initial states, all the reachable states satisfies L by this assumption here. So which means that every reachable state will also satisfy both P and L. Okay? So this is a stronger rule because it allows us also to prove P, that P is invariant using an auxiliary field. Okay, any questions? Okay, now let's go back to K-induction. I think this has been described by Fabio the other day. The idea of K-induction is to unroll induction to K-steps rather than one step. So the base case of K-induction is to show that every trajectory of length K that starts with an initial state satisfies P. So every state along that trajectory of length K satisfies P. And then the industrial step says that if you start from a chain of k steps that all satisfy key, then the next, any reachable state, any successor of the last step of that sequence will be satisfied. Okay? And as you can see, this is like a stronger case of induction. Actually, the normal induction is the k induction with k equals 0, I guess. So in most cases, this is better than induction. So there are properties you can prove with k induction that you cannot prove with induction at some specific value of k. And you can also think of k-induction as an automatic way of doing an invariant strengthening. Because essentially, you can show that if p is probably invariant by k-induction, if and only this property here, which says that p or next time t, and so on, is probable k-induction. So this property here implies p, and if this one is invariant, we have found a stronger invariant than p. So you have to be careful that in some cases, depending on the properties of the transition relation, k-induction doesn't buy you anything. And a specific example of that is if T is a reflexive transition, is a reflexive relation, which means that every state is a successor of itself, then k-induction is equivalent to normal induction. Okay? Everybody sees that? Essentially, what it means is that if you have a counterexample to induction, so if you have x that satisfies p, you do one step and get x prime that satisfies not p, then by the fact that the transition relation is transitive, you can extend this into any trajectory of length k. Essentially, so it says that if you have a counterexample to induction of length 1, you can generalize it to a counterexample to induction of length k for any. Okay, these are the same thing in pictures. So
just to,
yeah?
On the previous slide, so you're saying that it can be non deterministic with x. You can always stay in the same state when making a transition, you can also non deterministic.
Yeah. All this transition relation is telling you the possible successors of every state. And there can be always more than one.
It wasn't only
the place. That's not what I mean. Okay, this is a picture. So, property is invariant if it encloses the reachable state. So this is an example of what I just saw. This is an invariant property that's not inductive because there's a counterexample to induction Fourier. And this is a picture that tries to explain to you how the use of an auxiliary lemma can allow you to remove some of these unreachable properties. Okay. So you know that L is an auxiliary lemma. You know that L is invariant. And so this counterexample that prevented you from proving p by induction here is no longer relevant in this case. Okay, so this is the background. You've already seen all that stuff in the previous days. So let's see how we can apply all that stuff to some time. So what we're trying to do is to model time system as straight transition system so that we can apply our technology. And we want to be able to do bounded knowledge checking and induction styles of proof to this system. In the literature, you'll find that there are basically two general classes of models in which the time is implicit, and the prime example of that is something called timed automata. And I will describe an example of timed automata in a minute. There are also other variants of that, like time process algebras and so on. And there's a much more less research, but pretty simple idea is to add an explicit time variable to your models and add some transition relation that encodes the progress of time. Essentially, you have an explicit time variable and you say from time to time, time increases. Okay. So let's see what's a time automata. This is a very simple example. It's a finite state graph. In this case, we have four steps. Inside, and there's a clock X inside each state, the clock x increases monotonically, and then from time to time, depending on the condition relation here, on the arrows, you can move from one state to the next, and you can also reset the clock. Okay, so this example here, you are in the automaton is in the sleeping state for a while. It can take this transition at any time, provided this condition is satisfied. When it takes this transition, the clock is reset to zero. It stays in that state for some amount of time, and that time cannot be more than one. So it's not going to stay here for more than 1 minute. This is what the purpose of this constraint here is about. And it can exit that state via this transition, provided this condition is satisfied, and it also reset the clocks in this part. And here it goes into the trying state, and depending, it can stay in there forever, for as long as it wants. Then when it exits, it can go back here, depending on whether the clock value and the lock, the constraint on the lock, is satisfied. Okay? And it goes back to Conchical, and then eventually back here and so on. Okay? So that's basically a way of describing time system by having clocks, which are real values, variables that vary continuously, and states, and other discrete variables that vary discretely. So we can easily turn that stuff into a state transition system. So I'm just encoding part of the previous example. So you saw that the automaton had some discrete transition when we go from the sleeping state to the waking state. So we just reset the clock to zero, and nothing has changed except the state. Here we have another discrete transition. We are in a trying state for some value of the clock. If the lock is equal to I, then we can go to this other state here in the critical section. And as you can see, one property of the discrete transition is they never change the they don't increase the clock. So you can imagine, essentially the idea is that the discrete transitions are instantaneous. They take no time. And in addition to that, we just add a time progress transition that just tells us how to increase time. And what happens is, when time increases, the state doesn't change, the value of the lock doesn't change, but all the clocks, in this particular case, there's only one clock, will increase by some positive amount delta. And there is non-determinism in the choice of delta. Delta can be any arbitrary positive value, non-negative value. So using this model, you can actually do bounded model checking for time automata, and there are some... Delta can be zero. It's useful in some cases to have zero time transition. And that's a problem, we'll come back to that. I like that flow here. So this can be used for bounded model checking, but it's not very good for K-induction. One of the problems is this zero-time transition, which basically means that the transition relation is reflexive. And as we saw before, if your transition relation is reflexive, K-induction is equivalent to normal induction. So this is going to cause us a problem, this property that you can always increase time by some small amount. We can attempt to fix that by removing this requirement, having a stronger requirement here, as you suggested. Make sure that delta is strictly positive, but again, that still doesn't quite work in practice, because we still have the case that delta can be arbitrarily small. So what that means is, if we have a counterexample to induction, assume we have something that's P, does a time transition for some delta greater than zero, and gets to a state that's not P. And just like before, we can expand this counterexample to another counterexample of arbitrary length by just splitting this delta in smaller pieces. So we can do delta 1, delta k, and then prime. And the only constraint is that the sum of the delta 1 plus delta k is equal to delta. Okay? So what happens is just as before, if we have a counter example to normal induction, then we immediately have a counter example to K induction for any K. Okay? And as before, this means that K induction and induction are equivalent in this. Okay, so let's consider a different approach where we are going to use explicit time. So I put a quote here from this mentor, who has been advocating for this. Real time is really simple, and his idea is you should use just consider time as an extra variable and treat it like everything else. So this is what we are going to do. We introduce a global time variable, and we are going to control all the time elapses or time progress by incrementing time by jumps. And one particularity of this approach is we try to control, make sure we only jump to interesting parts. We don't want to do things like that here, where we basically increment time by some small amount of delta, but nothing interesting happens. We just continue incrementing time by some smaller amount and so on. We just want to force time step to go from an interesting state to another next interesting state. Okay? So the way we do that is we are going to use timeout variables. So every component in the system will keep track of a time in the future when it has something interesting to do. And then we'll have a global clock module that reads all these timeout variables and decides how far to increment the global time. Okay? So essentially we do, this is like using discrete time because we always do some interesting jump, but the size of the jump is not a constant. So here is what I just said in a more precise way. So we'll have in our models a global time, and each component in the system will have a timeout. So the timeout and the time are all real value variables. We also have discrete variables for describing the control part of the system. And the invariant we want to maintain is that tau i, the timeout for the component I, always stores the time in the future where component I has some interesting thing to do. And we want to maintain this invariant here, that all the timeouts are in the future. So as before, we will have two kinds of transition. In discrete transition, I should say that discrete transitions are possible only for component I when the current time is equal to its current timeout. So every component keeps track of when it has something to do. When the global time reaches that time, it can perform a discrete transition. And all these discrete transitions never change the time, so discrete transition doesn't change the time, and you must update your timeout to something larger to avoid stalling or deadlocks. Okay? And then the time progress transition is just what I said before. You can let time advance, provided all the timeouts are strictly in the future. Okay? In some sense, these transitions are priority over the time. And you advance time to whichever timeout is the smallest. Okay? You jump to the nearest event where something interesting has to happen. So here is a very classical example of that everybody who is doing a time system has tried. It's the Fisher's mutual exclusion protocol. So it uses two parameters. These are the timeout values, delta 1 and delta 2, and it requires that delta 1 will be smaller, strictly smaller than delta 2 in this example. There is a shared variable that's shared by n processes, and initially it is equal to 0. And each process will execute this loop. You just wait until the lock is 0. Once the lock is 0, you wait for some delay d that must be no more than this delta 1 constant here. At that point, you set the lock to I. You wait a little bit more for a time at least as large as delta 2. And then you check. If the lock is still equal to I, then you can enter the critical section. If the lock is different from I, then you go back to the beginning. And the timed automata I showed you before is actually the timed automata that encodes this problem. Okay, here is what it looks like in SAL. So I forgot to say that SAL is a sense for symbolic analysis laboratory. It's basically a language for describing state transition systems. And it also comes with different model checkers, including one model checker that uses SMT solvers as a matter. So here is what the process looks like. So it reads as an input the global time. The lock is also a global value that it can read or write. And it provides, it has its own timeout, so this is the flow I was discussing about before. And it has a program counter. And here are some examples of transitions here. So for example, if you are in the, if the process is in a sleeping state, when the time is equal to its timeout and the lock is zero, it can switch to the waiting state and it updates its timeout to guarantee that it will wait for some positive amount, but no more than delta. Okay? So this is a constraint on how long you stay in that particular state. And that's in a similar way, you can you have constraints on that tell you how long to wait after you've set the lock, and then you can check what happens in, after you've reached the train state, you can enter the critical section provided the lock passage. And so on. So using this technique, you can describe the variety of time systems, provided that you know how to control the timeout and you know how to set different values. This is the clock module. This is the module that just reads everybody's timeout and decides how to increment time. And as I said before, this is the rule. You say you can increment time if it's smaller than all the timeouts, and then you increment it to whichever element in this timeout array is the minimum. And here is the mutual exclusion property. This is the property we want to prove, that no two processes are in the critical section at the same time. And we can try to prove it by induction, but actually it's not inductive. And so the proof method for this particular case is based on these auxiliary lemmas here. So the first lemma is the first step is an invariant strengthening. Yeah, I'm not sure it's actually stronger than this one. But anyway, we use this auxiliary lemma, and this is going to be enough to provide it to verify this mutual exclusion property. And to prove the lemma itself, we need this other lemma. And then this other lemma actually depends on these other two simple lemmas here. So you can see that this one is pretty obvious. It says that the timeouts are always in the future. That's the simple auxiliary lemma that you can all prove by normal induction. But essentially, that's how we do the proof in this case. We start with this, we try to prove it by induction, doesn't work. We find some auxiliary lemmas, we prove them by induction, also by using other auxiliary lemmas, and then we have a complete chain. All these lemmas can be proved by normal induction using either some previous lemma or just using them. Okay? Yeah?
How can you find these lemmas?
Yeah, that's an important question. In this particular case, there was no automation involved. You just try to prove it using induction or whatever. You look at the counterexamples, and then you think hard, and that gives you some idea of what the next invariant should be. So there's a, you have to understand what's going on and figure out the lemma right now. Okay. In this particular case. Yeah.
What's going on with the PCJ and the length of weight? Does that seem that the two can't be rated from that?
Yeah, that's
it seems very is it so when they get if you're going to the weight to say you put aside like you
got yeah, because the problem is if you're on the so let's go back to the it's because of this here. If the lock of I is equal to I and TC is here, then it will enter the critical section. So for this to be safe, you have to make sure that nobody else is in this nobody else is in the waiting stage. Because if somebody else is in the waiting stage, then it can overwrite the waiting is here. If somebody else is in the waiting stage, then it has Yeah, I don't remember why it works, but it's a. And it's not a key, it's a key property. Yeah, that's kind of the idea, but there's two wasting stages here. So, okay, so that was a simpler example. It doesn't have any of the more complicated stories. It doesn't have real-time communication. It doesn't have rules anymore. So let's look at, yeah? Probably possible, but I don't think it's a good idea. I mean, it's always better to start your model from the in the framework you want to use rather than going through some other framework and doing a translation. Especially if you have to do things like invariant discovery by hand, it's a lot easier if you start from the same format. But I don't know. That's my conjecture. Okay. So now let's look at how to model communication delays and other kinds of delays. So the example we've seen before, the Fisher example, every communication was done via a shared variable. And the assumption was that the writing and reading to that shared variable was important. In real systems, we have more complicated communication mechanisms. In particular, in example like the TT Ethernet, processes communicate by sending messages to each other. So we need to model how long it takes for this message to be received. And our solution is something I call the calendar automata, where the essential idea is you have a set of messages that are pending, and each message is labeled with an arrival time. So the time when it's going to be received. So you can sort all these pending messages into an event queue, and the time progress rule is now modified to take these pending messages into account. You advance time either to the next timeout, so the next interesting time for a loop for a particular process, or to the next arrival time of one of these pending messages. Okay? And the operation of sending messages basically you add events to this queue, and you just non-deterministically or you with a sub constraint, you label all the messages with some duration. How long is going to take for this message? So here's my case study in this case. This is a variant of TTE, it's actually a predecessor of TTE, which is called the time trigger architecture, and I'm going to look into the startup protocol of this system. So TTE is like TTA is like TTE, except that it has a more restrictive network topology. It works only for networks that are of this form, where you have a set of nodes communicating to each other via a hub. Okay? And the idea of the time-triggered systems in general, and TTA is an example of this, is to guarantee that everybody operates using a common communication schedule, or a common schedule in general, which in this case means that communication into this network will be done in TDMA modes, which means that everybody has a reserved slot, and anyone is allowed to transmit data in that slot, N2 is allowed to transmit data in that slot, and so on. And the hub is going to prevent faulty nodes from sending messages when it's not their time to send. Okay? For this to work, as I said, it needs to be to make sure that every node is synchronized because they have to know when it's their time to send. They also need to know who is sending the current message. This says on the message traffic here, you don't need to put the sender of the message. in the payload. And something I should say is this is a picture of a simplified version of TTA. The real TTA actually has two hubs because it wants to tolerate failure of one. So what's the goal of the startup protocol? So during startup, everybody powers up. They start in an unknown state, and the goal of the startup is to go from this unknown, unsynchronized state into this TNA state. Okay. So here's a quick overview of how the startup protocol works. So each node is going to execute this protocol. This is the initial state after power up. It's going to stay in that state for a while, then move to the listen state. In the listen state, it's going to listen for traffic on the bus, on the communication link. And if it sees nothing for a while, for a sufficient amount of time, it's going to send something called a call start frame on its output, and it moves to this state. So it's basically trying to wake up everybody else in the network. In the call start state, you wait for a certain amount of time, and you also listen. If you receive a specific frame called iframe, which I don't know what it really, don't remember what it means, you move into the active state. When you receive that frame, it means that somebody has started synchronizing the system, and you just synchronize with the guy. In the listen mode, it can also happen that you enter the listen mode while the system is already synchronized. Then all you have to do is just go into the active mode. And then in the call start state, if you receive nothing, then you send another call start frame, and then you move back into this state. Okay? And the reason why this stuff actually works is that there are some specific timeouts you have to use in the listen state and in the call start state. And the timeouts are designed so that there will be no collision between different messages in this mode. Okay, so these are more precisely what the timeout constraints are. There's a fixed notion of the only is going to be around, which is the number of nodes in the system times the size of the transmission slot. Each node knows when it's positioned inside the schedule, which is defined by this constraint here, and it will have two timeouts. Depending for one timeout for how long it stays in that listen state, and one other timeout for how long it stays in that other state. And there's also a constraint between this tour bar here and the transmission delays along the links. Okay, so here is how we model it in SAR. We have two types of messages. Some are called call start frame, and some others are called iframe. And we stored in this data structure, we stored basically the information about who is going to receive the frames, the current frame that's pending, going to be transmitted, and the origin of that frame. Okay. And as I said before, we store the delivery time, the time when the message is supposed to be communicated. And I also added the send time, but it's actually not really used by the protocol. It's just used by time. Some of the debugging and input. Okay. So here is an encoding of the protocol that I just described it. So if you are in the listen state and your timeout expires, you move to the call start, you update your timeout, and you broadcast a call start frame. If you receive a call start frame in a call start state, the synchronize with the sender, which is encoding this way. Okay, and the clock module, I think you can skip that, basically what I said before. The time can advance if there is nothing to be received at the current time, and there is no timeout to be triggered at the current time. Okay, so here's a summary. We have a bounded queue, bounded set of messages that we use to modify to model the communication delays. We have timeouts that tell us when each node is supposed to make the discrete transition, and the the stuff we put in the calendar is just the messages that are finished. We've done two variant models of this TTA startup. Mm-hmm. We've started with a very simplified version of TTA where there's no failure at all. And then a more advanced version where one of those sending nodes may be different. Okay, so here is the property we want to prove. We want to prove that when two nodes are in the active state, then they agree on their timeout, they agree when that state is, when the particular schedule is going to terminate, and they also agree on who is going to send in that particular state. Okay, that's the synchronization property we want to achieve. And the proof method is based on K-induction and some form of abstraction that's also going to be proven by induction. Okay, so there's a direct proof or semi-direct proof that works if you have a small enough network. Essentially, you use some small, relatively obvious auxiliary lemmas. Then you can prove the property directly by induction at depth 8, using these as auxiliary lemmas. Okay. But the problem is this proof is actually not very scalable. It works only for very small instances. It works for n equals 2. Okay, so what we want is a better name. And you can actually prove that it's not, if you put n bigger than 2, this property is not k-inductive for whatever, for any k. So now, since we want to do a more scalable proof, we are trying to use only simple induction, that is induction with k equals 1. And as was discussed many times before, the main problem is how do we find the inductive invariant that's going to help us. I'm going to use the bounded model checker as a way to help us finding the inductive invariant when we get counterexamples to our induction proofs. We examine the counterexample and try to find some insight from there to discover our invariants. And then we can also, I'm going to describe a method that's related to disjuncting invariants and verification diagrams for doing some kind of abstraction. Okay, essentially all the abstraction is summarized in this picture. If you look at what the protocol actually does, it's divided in these two main phases. This is the cold start phase. In that phase, nobody is active. And this is the synchronized phase, actually, where in that phase, some of the nodes are active, and all the active nodes are synchronized. In this initial phase, what happens here is, in this state here, everybody is sleeping, so nobody is ready to send anything. At that point here, one node decides to send a cold start frame, so this is A2, and then enter the wait period, and then it will wait for some amount of time, and then eventually some other node, or maybe the same node, will send another cold start frame, and that part, starting from here, whoever receives that cold start frame will be synchronized. So we'll go into the active node. The reason why we cannot synchronize immediately on this first frame here is that there's a chance that the two nodes send the cold start frame at the same time. If two nodes send the cold start frame at the same time, there will be a collision, and you cannot guarantee, we don't know who will receive that particular frame. So here we have a possibility of collision between two cold start frames. But because of the way the timeouts are set up, there is no risk of collision in that second step here. So that's the key to the algorithm. You start the first cold start frame. There's no lock here, but the timeout guarantees that the transmission of... You may have two nodes ready to send another cold start frame, but they will have different timeouts, and the timeouts will guarantee that the transmission will not overlap. One of them will have a smaller timeout than the other. So there's some asymmetries in the timeout that guarantee the second transmission has no collision. Okay? And so this small automaton here is describing which the transition between these different phases, and there are some possibilities of failure that go back from F4 to F3 and so on. So how do we encode all that stuff in SAG? So we just describe what the different properties are, or the systems are in each of these different phases. So initially phase, there are no messages being sent, and everybody is either in the initial state or in the listen state. Everybody is just. In the second state, you have some message is pending, somebody has sent a call start frame. The sender of that call start frame we know is in the call start mode, and all these constraints are satisfied. Everybody else is either in the initial state or in the listen state, so everybody has either sent a call start or is still listening. And there are some constraints on the timeouts of everybody, of the possibly different nodes that are in this call start mode. Okay? So by doing this, you come up with a different Boolean state that describes the constraint between the different phases of the algorithm. And what we have to prove is that this abstraction is completely correct, in the sense that transitions, in the sense that there is no other transitions than the ones that are described in this diagram here. There's no other state, and there's no other transition than the one that are shown here. Okay, and the result of this is if the abstraction is correct, then it follows pretty much immediately that the disjunction of all these phases is an invariant, is an inductive invariant. Okay, so when we do that inside, what we do is we take our initial model of TTA and we export all the state variables. We have an abstractor, a module, which is basically the module that defines all these variables, all these Boolean variables, A1, A2, and so on. And then we have a monitor, which is going to observe how the transitions between the different A1 to A6 happen, and it will raise a flag if some transition happens which was not supposed to happen, that doesn't follow the diagram. Okay? And essentially, it follows from this idea that the abstraction is correct if and only if you can never raise the flag, you never reach the last state. Okay? Okay, so this is roughly what I just said. So the monitor gets Boolean input, which corresponds to these different phases. It keeps an internal state that tells it in which what is the current state, what is the current phase, and then it observes what happens when which transitions are triggered, and it raises the flag. It goes to the bad state as soon as some condition that's not allowed is observed. So there's a bench. So now what the rest of the work is basically show that this transition never happens, the state is never bad. And we can use a bunch of auxiliary invariants from this form. It basically says that if you are in state A1, then condition A1 is true. If you are in state A2, then condition A2 is true, and so on. And we want to prove this. Okay, and so this is how it all goes together. We prove some auxiliary elements using induction. It typically doesn't work for the more difficult properties, so we can use this abstraction idea. We define our abstraction predicates. Again, this has to be done by hand. We don't have yet an automatic way of doing this. We can specify an abstraction diagram, or sometimes you don't really need the abstraction diagram. You encode it as a monitor, and then you show that the abstraction is correct by proving that the bad state is unreachable. Everything, once you have this approach, the advantage is that every proof can be done by induction at that point, which makes the proof more scalable because you don't have to unroll the transition relation too much. And, okay, so this was the general idea. Now I'm going to go back to one thing I haven't discussed yet, is how we're going to model faults in the TTA startup model. So for the simplified TTA model as developed, we assume that the hub doesn't fail, and there's at most one faulty node. But the faulty node can be Byzantine, we can have arbitrary bad behavior. So we specify this in SALT by making sure, so we use an auxiliary variable. The only reason we have this auxiliary variable is we want to make sure there's no more than one faulty node. So we assume some predefined node is going to be the faulty node. But we don't give an explicit value to this, which is one node will be faulty. And then we add a state to our model that says, that corresponds to being faulty. Okay? Then the faulty node, this guy here, is allowed to jump into the faulty node at any point in the algorithm. So from any state, it can update, it can, from any possible state, it jumps to the faulty node and just updates its timeout non-deterministically. And once it is in the faulty node, in the faulty state, it can do whatever it wants. So it can send arbitrary messages at an arbitrary amount, at arbitrary time. So this is what these two transitions describe here. There's a non-deterministic choice between sending an iframe or CS frame, and then there's also a non-deterministic choice in updating the time. So this tells you that this means that the faulty node can update, can send message at arbitrary point in time. There's only one small constraint here, is that you cannot send so fast that there's a minimal amount of time that takes to send a message, so you cannot send faster than that. Okay? And this is an important step to avoid what's known as Zeno behavior. Okay, so this is just to give you some idea of how it works. After we put everything together, this is what we get. So I looked here as the TTS started with 10 nodes. In a simple case where there is no fault at all, which tells you that you have 13 state variables and 39 discrete variables. And this is the runtime I got for verification this morning. It takes about 20 seconds to verify all the lemmas. It takes about 2 minutes to verify that the abstraction is correct. And then it's almost instantaneous to show that the synchronization property is implied by the abstraction. And in the case of the fault tolerance model, which is more complicated, it takes more time to prove the lemmas, it took less time to prove the abstraction, and the synchronization property is implied by the abstraction, but it takes a little bit more time. So there is a little bit of a surprising behavior in this case, is that the abstraction in this case was proved faster than in this case, even though the abstraction in this case is much more complicated. I was using Yikes at the backend for this, but you could use some other SMT for it.
Can you
show
me can you give an estimate of the human labor required to come up with the proof structure?
I'd say maybe 1 or 2 days for the simple case. And once you've done the simple case, the other one is not so hard.
What is the amount of lemmas that you can reuse throughout the various properties?
Well, there are a few obvious lemmas that you reuse all the time. There are lemmas, basically lemmas about how long it takes for communication to happen. Lemmas about the timeout. If you are in a certain state, you know that the timeout, you have some constraint on the timeout. So these ones are relatively systematic, but they are not shared across verification. But they all look the same, you just need to change the different values depending on which one you need. Okay, so that was one example. That's probably the more complicated example. I've done with this thing. So let's look at another case. So let's go back to TTE. So as I showed you a TTE architecture in the beginning, this is a variant architecture. So TTE is a non-trivial Ethernet. You have ANT systems talking to switches, and you have arbitrary topology of switches. Okay, what do we care about clock synchronization? As I mentioned in the beginning, physical clocks are not perfect and they drift from real time. And we cannot. Essentially, what that means is if you read the value of a clock at time t1 and compare it to its value at time t0, it's not going to be exactly equal to t1 minus t0. It's going to be t1 minus t0 modulo some small rate here. And the rate here is relatively small, but depending on which kind of clocks you want, and more expensive clocks have a better rate than others. So, irrespective of the particular value of this row here, what this means is after enough time, you cannot guarantee that two clocks will be synchronized even if they start in a synchronized state. Even if they start equal, after a while there will be a large, arbitrarily large difference between two clocks. So we don't want that because in TTE this means that since everything depends on synchronization, if we lose that property, everything will fail. So communication will fail, the frames will collide, and we cannot guarantee anything anymore. So to keep the system synchronized, you have to periodically correct for this drift between the clocks. Okay, so this is a quick overview of how that works. So in TTE, there is a division of labor. Each node in the system will have a specific role. Some nodes are designated as synchronization masters. These are the ones that trigger resynchronization. When they figure out that the current synchronization period has been reached, they trigger a synchronization by broadcasting the value of their local clock. Other components, which are usually the switch, they receive the value from these masters, the synchronization masters. They wait until they get a large enough number of different messages from the synchronization masters. Then they apply something they call a compression function that's computing an average of these different values. Then they broadcast the compression value to everybody. And then in the last step of the protocol, everybody gets a compression value from one or more compression masters. They apply another averaging function, and then they use that for correcting their clock. And as I said before, in a single fault scenario, we assume that there is one Byzantine faulty synchronization master. And in the two-fold scenario, we assume that there are only two faulty synchronization masters, but they are not Byzantine. They satisfy this inconsistent omission assumption, which means that either they send the right value or they send the right. Okay, this is the structure of the SAL model for this. Essentially, it's going to consist of n independent compression masters. So I skipped the synchronization client in this case because essentially the synchronization master also has the role of synchronization client in the last part of it. So you will have n compression master, a model of the connection and also between the different nodes, also a model of the fault, and then on the other side you have the synchronization master. This is the synchronization function applied by the synchronization master. They are going to receive, in the fault scenario I've described, there is no fault from the compression master, so you are guaranteed that all the synchronization masters will receive two values. So the two compression values, so they will correct their clock by computing the average between the compression. That's what the protocol requires. And so the model basically consists of three states. In the send state, essentially the clock will be, the local clock will be made available to the synchronization master. Then they wait for a compression input for a compression value from every compression master, and then they move into this drift track where just I model by some arbitrary update to the curve that corresponds to the changing to the drifting of the curve. Okay? And then at the end of this, we go back to the distance. Okay. Here is the compression function. The way it works is every compression master will receive a number of clock readings from the different synchronization masters. So because of the fault assumptions, we don't know exactly how many will be received. Then the compression master will sort all these values in increasing order, and then the compression is defined based on these sorted values. If it consists of only one value, you will send it. If it consists of two values, you pick the average. If it consists of three values, you pick the one in the middle. If it's four values, you pick the average, the mid value, the medium. If it's five, you pick the one in the middle. And otherwise, you have this formulation, which depends on k. But k is a fixed parameter. K is the degree, or maybe false, if you want to take it. So it's either one. So as you can see here, there's one that's in red, and actually we figured out during this analysis that this is not a very good choice for the compression. Yeah. And there's a better choice, and we figured out that the better value would be this. Essentially, the previous value does not. Okay. Okay, so here's a model of how you encode all that stuff in SAMP. Essentially, you apply a different the compression output depending on how many messages you received, and you after sorting them in increasing order. So this is the case for three reading, this is the case for four, and this is the case for five, using the original definition of the compression. Okay. So in this particular case, one of the tricks that people use, which is a very nice trick, is to model all the nodes are non-faulty. You don't have a special model for nodes, you just assume all nodes are faulty, and you encode the fault assumptions as constraint on the transmission. Essentially, you say that instead of saying a node is faulty, you're going to say this node will behave properly, but nobody will receive what it sends. That's the basic idea. So we encode that by using these two variables here. For every pair of compression and synchronization masters, we have a flag that says that's true if the compression master J has received a message from the synchronization master I, and otherwise it falls if the message was lost or the sender sent nothing. And then we have another variable that's for the value sent. And then the fault model is encoded in these rules. Yeah. If the sender is not faulty, then the message is sent as sent, is received as sent. So the message is received, and the value is whatever the sender. It is exactly what the sender sent. If the sender is obviously faulty, then the value is correct, but this flag here that says whether the message was received or not, will be received or not, can be set to either true or false non-deterministically. And in the last case, if the sender is Byzantine, then both the value it sent and the flag are non-deterministically set. Okay, so this is a more the more arbitrary fault scenario. You can send arbitrary value or you decide not to send any. Okay, so now our goal is to show that the compression function that we propose is actually better than the one they proposed, the original compression function. So here is the idea. What we are going to do is to find a specific clock precision. So in both cases, and we are going to prove that this is actually the best clock precision we can achieve in this particular model. So this amounts to do two things. We want to show that this property is invariant, that the clocks of two, in this particular case, I'm concentrating on the compression masters. So the clock, the difference between the clocks of two compression masters is never more than this, which tells us that this is the guarantee, this is an upper bound on how good the synchronization is. Then we show that this one, which is just obtained from the first one by replacing the less than or equal by a strict less, is actually false, which means that this is the best you can do. This is the actual exact clock. Okay. This one gives you an upper bound, this one says you that this is actually the, there is no better upper bound. Okay. Okay, so here are the results. For the original compression function, we managed to prove that the clock precision was 4, and for the revised compression master, we managed to prove that the clock precision is 3. So we show that this invariant is true, this one is not true, this one is true, and this one is not true, which is what we wanted. And this established what we wanted. It shows that this version is better than the other version. Yeah, I mean, that's, we can go into this. Not really. I mean, once you understand why the choice, so basically what happens is you have SN, assume you have SN5, will send 5 messages to 2 compression masters. So CM1 will get D1, D5, and if we sort them in equivalent order, we can assume this D5. And we have this 3 here in the middle. And CM2, we have D1, D2, D4. If the senders are not faulty, V1 will be the same as V1, V2 will be the same as V2, and so on. Modulo sounds more precise. But if you have a faulty, Byzantine faulty sender, what can happen is it can send a value that's V5, it can send V5 to one, and it can send V1 to the other. And in that case, what happens is you can end up in a scenario where you get something that looks like that. Like that. And then you will get okay. So what's happening is these two messages are coming from one faulty Byzantine faulty sender. The first one will click V3. This other one will click V prime. So the best synchronization you can achieve is the difference between these two things.
But this is something you figure out once you knew really that one is better than the other. What's the reason?
I was trying to prove the thing correct. I found this example by trying to prove it.
So that you find that not from the proof?
No. The proof came after I found the mistake in the I was doing it using a totally different tool, not using model shaping at all. I was trying to. Okay, so the best you can do in this case is the difference between this three and this five. Based on what we know about how far the clocks are, this basically means that we can get an upper bound on this. I mean, there's a scenario where basically all the clocks. I don't know how to explain this. Anyway, there's a bound here, and in the worst case, this bound is as large as what you started. So there's no, essentially no resynchronization. The two clocks that these two guys are picked are not closer together than when they receive. Now, if you use the revised compression function, what you will get is talk again, we'll get these two plus these four. We have two, and the other guys will have a question of the correction value of v prime 2 plus v prime 4. So basically what you have is an interval like that. We know that in this V2, we know a bound between the difference between V2 and V4. We know that V2 and V4 cannot be very far apart. So we know that V2 might be here and V4 might be here. And we also know that V prime 2 can be here, V prime 4 here. Okay? We also know by the V3 somewhere in the middle. And so what happens is we can show at that point, I'm not sure I can reproduce the proof, that the difference between V2 plus V4 over 2 and V prime 2 plus V prime 4 over 2 is half of delta. So after this correction, you know that the two are together by essentially half. There's a little bit of a first factor, but that's essentially what happens. In this other case, you start with delta, you end with delta. So you basically don't improve the prime. That's kind of the overall idea of why this works better.
Replace the V2 with an average.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be careful because, again, you have to consider that the V2 might be malicious. So it's not an easy way to. Okay, I think that's all I have to say. So, well, I've described the different applications of SMT solvers in fault tolerance systems. The main benefit is they allow you to do semi-automated proofs of relatively complicated systems using model checking. What makes these systems complicated is the fact that you have to handle time, the fact that you have to handle faults, and you have relatively complicated protocols. You have to understand that SMT solvers are not just there for doing bounded model checking. Using these proofs by induction, you can also use them to do actual proofs, verification. This part is still something that's required right now, at least in the approach I've described, is there is some human guidance. The human has to find the right hand or the right inductive assumptions. This is much better. This has changed my life a lot. Before, I was doing this kind of work a long time ago. And before SMT solver, there was no available model checking technology for doing this. There were some model checking technology, like model checkers for type automata, but they were not scalable enough, and they could not handle the complication related to fault models and so on. So we were restricted to use something called interactive theorem proving, which is much, much work than that. It takes forever, it requires a lot of effort, and it requires a lot of expertise, which means that nobody in the industry, nobody in the application domain really want to do it. But they are willing to use SMT server. So the main challenge, as you can easily see, is how do we automate the discovery of all these inductive invariants and all the OC. That's still the main part. It's still the part of the world that's not automated and that requires some thinking. And depending on how complicated your system is, you may be so obvious. So all the techniques that Ken discussed yesterday, and also some other techniques, even the IC3 work, possible extension of IC3 that people are working on, will be applicable to this case. I don't know yet. I would imagine that finding the exact same invariance you find by thinking about it is beyond the scope But still, they may be able to find the easy ones, and they also may be able to even fully automatically generate some invariants that may not be easy to understand for the human, but still able to do. Okay? I think that's all I have to say. Thank you. It's not a predecessor, it's still continuing.
Oh.
But it's a different technology. It's not an automated tool.
Yes.
From my colleague that is not an automated tool. It's going to blow up because of, well, I haven't tried very hard, but because of the fact that you have fault models, that tends to lead to a greater blow up of the state space than usual. No, I mean this particular accident, well, like every accident, is a combination of factors, and it's hard to pin it down to computers or pilots. I mean, in this particular case, one of the pilots was wrong and basically drove the plane down to the sea.
Because the
yes, and also because it's more complicated than that. The pilot did not understand, did not know how the. So in the Airbus system, there's a default mode, and in default mode, the computer is in charge and it's guaranteed that the plane is never going to stall. In this, he didn't realize that the plane was not in this default mode because it had lost the people stuff, so it didn't have airspeed. And it was in a degraded mode. In a degraded mode, there's no protection against them. So the pilot was confused about that. There are other issues like there are two pilots, and they were reacting in a different way. One was trying to push the stick down, while the other was trying to push it up. The one pushing down was wrong, the one pushing up was wrong, and the other guy didn't realize it was pushing up. And the reason for that is they are only using joysticks. You cannot see the other guy's joystick from your seat. And there were other issues, although if the guy had just put the button that re-engaged the computer, everything would have been safe. Because at that point, the Peter tube had
de-iced,
and everything was fine. So there's always, I mean, this is what happens in accidents. There's always a combination of factors. And one of the main problems is usually this, the lack of understanding of the pilot. The pilot don't understand the control system. They fly it in some default mode that they cannot understand. When there's an accident, it moves in some strange mode that they haven't seen before, and it's really hard to understand what the plane is going to do in that mode. So there's always this combination of blame. The pilot was wrong, but the system may have been wrong. But maybe it's the right reaction. I mean, what do you do if you have faults, if you don't have speed? Maybe shutting down is the right thing to do. I mean, this stuff is just a very minor piece of the overall picture. And proving this kind of stuff is correct. It's not a guarantee against accidents. Yeah, I mean, it's a generic. I mean, this. If you look at this. This example here. When we model this node, we have a new state that's faulty, and we have arbitrary transitions that go from any of these states to the faulty state. That's what's causing the error. And it gets even worse because you have n, it's not just one guy that's faulty, everybody gets at the faulty state.
A couple of announcements for everybody that is talking. First, for people who are staying for the for SAP, for the conference.